You are listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
The Paranormal News Insider from ParanewsInsider.com. Produced by WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for the week of May 24th, 2016, and episode number 266. And this is your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. 266, wow. Anyway, welcome to another edition of the Paranormal News Insider. It's weird. It's like bright. It's like afternoon outside. Makes me feel like an old person. I got to go to bed, but show's not on it late at night, I guess. Maybe I should be on at 1 in the morning or something. I don't know. Anyway, this week's news includes There Goes the Neighborhood, since the Crocs are moving in. We'll also talk about, was that a ghost on live radio? That's an interesting story. We'll also talk about a ghost story in Iowa. We're going to touch on The Conjuring 2. Was it based on a real story or just a hoax? I might be stirring the pot with that story. I don't know. We'll find out. I might hurt some people's feelings. But I bring in the truth. That's what I do. A psychic scams another mark. And we'll also have the book of the week, Conscious Conventions, and a whole lot more. If we had the time, we'd cram all that in here. And this week's news is brought to you by Chum Bucket Studios. That's right, Chum Bucket Studios. They offer professional, high-quality digital products from prints to movies. Printing, signs, videos, video editing, even website graphics, and much, much more. It all begins with a little imagination. Check them out today at chumbucketstudios.com. That's Chum Bucket Studios. A friend of mine, Jay, runs Chum Bucket Studios. He met him at the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure a couple of weeks ago and talked about Chum Bucket Studios. And at the time, I was designing a website, Ohio Cryptid, for my new cryptozoological group here in Ohio. And I've always designed my own logos. I don't let anybody else touch things, which unfortunately sometimes is not good because people get a little upset by that. People, if they're in my group, they want to have a little bit of creativity their way as well. But I have a tendency to kind of take over the projects like that since I write all my own websites. But this time I had so much going on and I said, hey, are you interested in looking at what I've already accomplished and coming up with something else? And wasn't sure how it would go. And he and I talked, you know, pretty much like control over my projects. But he showed me what he could do, and I was extremely happy with it. And it's now up. And you can check that out at ohiocrypto.com. He designed the logo for my new group, and very, very happy with that based on my former logo. He kind of took that and he modernized it, made it a little bit more professional, I guess. But I really appreciate the work that he did on that. And that's why he's sponsoring the show too. I mean, he's great job. He's also designed the poster, the logo for the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure as well, which was awesome. I got a nice little poster here signed by a lot of people. And it was a great time then as well. Again, chumbucketstudios.com. And what else is going on out there in paranormal land? Well, in my neck of the woods, got some great stuff in the mail yesterday. I believe it was yesterday. Yeah, it was yesterday. A new little packet here from the International Cryptozoology Society. Now, this was founded earlier this year at the St. Augustine, Florida convention in January. It was an official announcement. Some of us already knew it was coming. It had been discussed in the paranormal news earlier on. So the ICS is a new organization, new group headed by Lauren Coleman, who is the leader of the International Cryptozoology Museum in Portland, Maine, and author of many of the top books in cryptozoology as well, and pretty much a living legend as far as cryptozoology is concerned here in the United States. My little packet here, I got a nice little welcome letter, and I got a journal by Carl Schuker, who put this journal out in 2012, the Journal of Cryptozoology, Volume 1 from November of 2012. Now, they're going to have their own journal coming soon for the ICS. And the ICS basically takes over for an older organization. They're not related. The International Society of Cryptozoology, which is an international, obviously, a group that attempted to bring science into cryptozoology and unfortunately went defunct back in 1997. But with this new adventure, they're going to, maybe not adventure, I guess would be the correct term. They're looking to bring science back to cryptozoology through a peer-reviewed journal. And that's one of the reasons why I jumped on this as a member. And being a member of the first year, you automatically become a founding member of this organization. Now, who knows? This could only last a year, 2 years, or it could last 100 years. Nobody really knows. But I think Lauren has really thought long and hard about this and has put together some pretty good stuff with Jeff Buse and some other people that are involved with this as well. The president is Paul LeBlanc, PhD. Lauren Coleman is the founder, and Jeff Muse is the vice president. And the welcoming packet, I got a little card here. It's a discount card for merchandise online, 10% off. You also get a discount if you go to the next convention. That's sometime next year. I haven't heard anything about that. You get a lot of little goodies, a lot of little stuff here in the mail, but the thing here also that I want to mention is if you want to join, you can go to ICZSonline.com. That's the International Cryptozoology Society, ICZSonline.com, and you can sign up, become a member. And if you mention my name when you sign up and you become a member, as soon as I find out about that, because it takes a little time, paperwork, you know how that goes. Once I get notification that you have mentioned my name to sign up, now you won't get any discounts or anything like that. My name won't bring you any kind of fame or fortune or anything like that, but I will hear about that. And if you let me know that you did, I will know. And I will send you some Paranormal News Insider swag in the mail as a payback for that. Because if you are a member and somebody mentions your name, I would be eligible for a discount on my following annual subscription. So that would be much appreciated, and I would pass that along as well. So International Cryptozoology Society, really excited about this. Can't wait for the journal. The first journal will be from the first convention or conference that happened in January of this year, some of the stuff that happened there. So looking forward to that. Also looking forward to tonight's show. Again, stirring the pot. Going to be talking about this Enfield poltergeist thing, about this new movie coming out, The Conjuring 2. A lot of people have asked me, hey, why don't you talk about the movies and stuff on here? Well, I guess part of the reason is that other people do that. Other people in the paranormal have their own radio shows, and I like to stay away from pre-existing formats or competing with other people in those particular formats. And I don't know, maybe I'll talk about stuff like that. I don't know. But I don't really think I'm going to be seeing The Conjuring 2. No offense. It's a little blown out of proportion for me, but I might check it out and I might talk about it. Who knows? I do like scary movies. I have no problem with that. It's just when they are like this, when they say or claim that they're based on real events, that and then you have people floating on the ceiling, which didn't happen. It's a little agitating, but those of us that take this stuff seriously. But anyway, before we get into that, I'm going to get into cryptid news. And this story is from Florida. I'm sure a lot of people have been to Florida, right? I mean, geez, who hasn't been to Florida? Florida is a scary place. If you know anything about the animals down there, there are some interesting animals down there. I've had the fortunate ability to travel to Florida on numerous occasions, probably too much, to be honest, over the years. But in the last, 10 years or so, I've been able to visit the Skunk Ape Research Center down in Okeechobee, Florida, home of the skunk ape down there. And just down the road, you can go and drive down this, rocky back road thing. And these alligators are right along the road. And if you get out of your car, they come up out of the water. I don't know if they let you pet you or not. I didn't get that far. I got back in the car and drove away because they're pretty big and scary looking. But Florida is home to all kinds of weird creatures and animals. Unfortunately, a lot of them are let loose illegally. And other ones are just cool in the wild. Here's a fast fact. If you've been to any of my speeches these last couple of weeks, I talked about in my presentations about macaque monkeys that are actually loose in Florida. They're loose. They're in the wild. Silver Springs, Florida, which is outside of Ocala, Florida, just east of that area, they're loose. They're hanging out in the trees. They're there. They've been there since the 1940s. And it wasn't because of a Tarzan movie. It was because of a local promoter there who wanted to continue to promote the park. The park actually, back in its day in the mid-1800s, was the birthplace of glass-bottom boats. There's your true fact for the day. And they brought these little macaque monkeys there and put them on a little island thinking that they're just going to hang out and never cause any trouble. Well, now there's over 300 of them all over the area, and occasionally they turn up as far away as Tampa. You hear about those on the news all the time. But beautiful area down there, Florida. Alligators, manatees. Haven't seen the monkeys yet. I was in the area, but didn't stop and see them this year. But so you already know that the alligator finds its home in Florida. And there's a lot of other states. I'm not leaving out Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia. All those guys down there in Mississippi, yeah, they exist down there. And they're moving north, too, which is scary. It's also home to Florida, the Florida panther, and again, many escape exotic animals. But you have those everywhere, right? Now, some of these exotic runaways or orphans, which, dumped animals that are dumped off because people don't want to take care of them, they grow a little bit too big to go to the pet store and feed them little mice. They want to actually eat Fluffy the dog there instead of the mice anymore when they get that big. The Burmese python, which can grow from 12 to 18 feet long, has been sighted and actually has a living range in parts of Florida. Yes, they actually have ranges where they're existing in the loose. They're not supposed to be there. And they actually can reproduce. And this is an area where they live quite nicely. Green anacondas have also been reported being established in the wild and have been noted as being as long as 18 feet, yet they are known as the heaviest snakes in the world and capable of consuming deer and jaguar in their native South American range. Yeah, I don't really want to get eaten by a snake. That'd be a little, what a way to go out. A recent story is a bit more disturbing, even more than all of that. The Nile crocodile, a species known to exist in Africa, has been spotted in Florida. Three juveniles have been captured between 2010 and 2014 in Florida. Well, why is this cause for concern? I mean, come on, we already have alligators down there. What's a crocodile between friends, right? Well, in the same time span, 2010 to 2014, Nile crocodiles have attacked 480 people and killed 123 in Africa. While the American alligator is nearly the same size, with males growing up to about 20 feet and weighing about 2,000 pounds, the Nile crocodile weighs a little bit more, about 2,500, or that of a Kia Rio. Not that I don't know if you've lifted a Kia Rio lately, but that's about the same amount of weight there. Yet the scary part here is they're much more aggressive to larger animals, including humans. I mentioned being on the road and getting out of the car. Well, yeah, these guys will come right up to you. They're not afraid of anything or anybody. You can't just shoo them off. They decide they want to come up to you and sniff you, sniff your leg. I don't know what they do, but they're very curious, and they want to come after you. But these crocodiles, the Nile crocodiles, they're actually aggressive, so not cool. And these are the kind of things that come flying out of the water at you when you're checking your reflection of the water out of like one of those scary movies, and gnaw on your head and pull you in the water, and you're gone. Like, where'd he go? Where's Dr. Brian? He's gone. Now, three crocodiles have been removed. Three juvenile Nile crocodiles. Say that 10 times fast. Now, this doesn't sound like that big of a deal, right? I mean, just three. But experts rationalize that finding these may indicate that there are many others that they have not found yet, or that they may have established themselves just because these three have been found. In fact, the crocodiles may be thriving, and they're actually known to grow much faster in Florida than they do in their normal range in Africa. That's a little scary to think about as well. Now, these three crocodiles are apparently related due to DNA testing and are not from local zoos or other captive locations, and are the closest, they're actually closest match to crocodiles living in South Africa. Now, don't get carried away and think that these guys swam across the ocean. They can swim in salt water, but yeah, I don't think they came here that way. I don't think they, you know, jumped on a yacht or caught a wave and made it here to the United States. Now, odds are they're just like many of the other invasive species and are being released into the wild by pet owners that realize they can no longer take care of this animal, or they no longer wish to. This latest story has been called a wake-up call for Florida to react to these activities to limit the damage to the ecosystem and keep Floridians safe. That's a scary story because, like I said, I love going to Florida. I love visiting down there. I'm usually a Bay Area kind of guy. I like the Gulf of Mexico side. Fort Myers Beach down, you know, it's a quick drive down to South Florida and check out all the cool animals down there. Dolphins and manatees and so on and so forth. But yeah, never seen a crocodile. I don't think I want to tangle with one of those guys either. So that's your cryptid news. Scary stuff from Florida. And it's just weird how all these weird animals are getting establishing themselves here in the United States. Food for thought. Hopefully you're not food for thought if you go down there. So ghost news. I got quite a bit of ghost news this week, and I kind of feel guilty because I really don't carry that much ghost news, it seems like. I don't know why. It's just kind of just the way it happens, I guess. But ghost news. First, a story about a ghost caught on film running through a house. Yes, a ghost caught on film running through a house. Apparently, in this film, it was wearing shoes. And now we know that the story is obviously fake, since everyone knows, everyone out there, come on, you know that ghosts only wear boots. Boots, get it? Boot. Oh, okay. All right, crickets. Anyway, that's not my fault. I stole that joke from Haley Stevens today from a tweet. I saw that and I actually chuckled a little bit. Maybe my delivery was off. I don't know. Anyway, story from Korea. And I was really hoping to get the audio and play it, but I couldn't download it. I didn't really have time to really figure it out. Usually I can download videos and separate the audio. It's usually not a problem. But this one was giving me trouble, so I didn't separate the audio. I was going to play the audio for you, but I'll provide the link in the chat room, as well as during the week, I'll post this story. If you haven't heard it, haven't seen it, you may have seen it from Korea, or rather heard it, I guess. Well, you got to read it, and then you can listen to it. Some may wonder if ghosts are able to appear as electronic voices on handheld recorders to investigators. Come on, we know that as EVP, right? I remember back in the day when you had to explain what EVP stood for. Now it doesn't matter the crowd. Everybody knows that. We might wonder, have they ever been heard live on live radio? And I know several shows I've been on, people have had guests that have encountered strange things or noises during their production work that couldn't really rightly be explained, but was it a ghost? I don't know. I know we here at WCJV go through plenty of chickens to appease the Skype gods. Now, whether or not that has anything to do with that, we've had to hire Dave Considine to do exorcisms on our microphones on occasion to make sure everything works. But whether or not that's ghosts, I don't know. I think it's a whole different category here that we're talking about. Well, this purportedly ghostly event happened during a live interview with an actor, Park Gun-hyung, a 38-year-old who is trained in musical theater and was asked to sing a song on live radio, that's always good, that he used while proposing to his future wife. Now, he starts singing, and as he starts singing, a ghostly echo, sounds like a female voice, can be heard that sounds perfectly in time and tune to what he is singing. Now, as he's singing, obviously, unless you speak Korean, you don't really know what he's saying, but you kind of get the gist by looking at the body language, looking at his face, and he's kind of looking around like, what is that voice? Cause he's hearing, you know, he's wearing headphones. So when you're in a studio, now you can hear, you kind of hear what everyone else is hearing. So you can kind of tell what's going on. And he heard this echo and he's looking around like, what is this noise? Where am I hearing this from? And, he was looking at the I don't know how many other people. The radio host was a female, and there had to be other people in the room as well, the camera person and whoever else. I don't know. But this female voice singing perfectly in time and tune. So he does acknowledge something's not right here. Now, it was only a few seconds long. He didn't really sing that long. He asked the radio host who was singing with him. But the host and others in the studio just seemed, they were just as confused as Park was. They had no idea what was going on. Now, was this a ghost? I watched it a few times, and I listened to the audio really loud and tried to figure out what's going on by watching what's happening, listening to what's happening. And I know this sounds bad. It sounds skeptical, but I'm just not sold on it that it's a ghost. It sounds like a good story. And the singing, to me, seemed more than likely to be caused by mild feedback into the microphone he was singing into. And I'll explain why. I think it was a combination of his heightened pitch. Now, he really went up pretty high and turned towards the microphone in the beginning to sing. In addition, he had his hand by his face, kind of pumping and funneling all that noise into the microphone. It wasn't really a high-end microphone either. And when he changes pitch and he kind of comes down, the volume changes, the sound goes away just prior to him finishing the song. And again, you might not understand what they're saying, but I highly recommend checking out the video and deciding for yourself if this was really a duet or a solo. But hey, not for me to say. It's just my opinion. That's just what I think from my observation of this particular story. But feel free to check it out. In the video, the two people there sitting side by side. The girl, there was a girl sitting next to him to his right, to on the left when you're looking at the video, and you could see the hand of the announcer there. And she said she wasn't singing, and it was obvious because you could see her, she wasn't singing. But I think it was just feedback into that little microphone there. Again, it's not really a highly professional microphone, I don't think. I mean, it's a good microphone, don't get me wrong. It's got the little spit guard on there, as I don't even use mine. I like to spit in my microphone, but it's a it's an interesting story, and I don't know. I could be wrong, but that's just my guess on that whole thing, and we'll see. We'll find out if anything comes about that story at all. So, moving along to a creepy story of a ghost in a house in Iowa. Brad Sapp of Carroll, Iowa, thought he heard a voice say, quote, "get out of here," unquote. Now, as an investigator, I'm sure I know I've heard similar words or similar phrases over my shoulder, in my ear, in my recordings. A lot of us out there have heard that stuff, so that's no big deal. But if you're not used to that kind of stuff, I can see how that can get to you. Now, he was at home, well, actually, this business. He was sorting cans in his redemption center. aluminum cans, I guess. Now, he was confused. He began looking for the source of the voice, but he was unable to find it. So his wife picked on him and joked with him and said, it was probably just a ghost, right? Well, good job, lady, because 8 hours later, she heard the voice for herself. Quote, "I'm in the chimney," unquote, came the voice, which startled Carrie, his wife. Then it came again, and the couple realized there's a man trapped in the chimney. 29-year-old Jordan Kajewski was not only caught in the chimney, but he was completely naked as well. Completely naked. Man, this show has gone downhill. Last week, I was talking about all kinds of weird stuff. Now we're talking about naked guys in chimneys. Anyway, Kajewski had clothes in the chimney with him as he was wedged 20 feet from the roof and had been stuck there overnight. Creepy. Now, I read some comments that maybe Carrie has some explaining to do to her husband, but in reality, Mr. Kajewski said that he told police he fell in the chimney while playing hide-and-seek with his cousin. And he stuck to that story during questioning. So I guess when you fell in the chimney, it tore your clothes off perfectly, and you were just wedged in there? Okay. Weird. Sapp had previously met the man as he had come in looking for a job on 3 separate occasions, asking for just a few hours of work. So that sounds a little fishy there. To me, it sounds like he was just coming in to scope out the area to steal some stuff or do something else. I don't know. Jordan was arrested on trespassing charges, and it took firefighters 30 minutes to free him from the chimney. And the Daily Times Herald in Carroll, Iowa, also states at the end of their article that it is unclear whether or not he won the game of hide and seek. I'm sure he did. What a way to go. He's a champion. He's not as good as Bigfoot, but good job on your hide and seek skills. I'll have to think about that the next time I'm playing hide and seek with anybody else. Climb up on a roof and slide down a chimney. And yeah, that would be embarrassing. So, weird story. Yeah, if you hear voices coming from above, it may not be ghosts in the attic. It might be some naked guy in your chimney. Creepy. So you never know. You know, it's that thing that we always say, those of us in the paranormal, we're not so much afraid of ghosts. We're afraid of the living. And this is just another fine example of those kind of creepy living people that scare the pants off of us. Well, I guess it scared the pants off of him. Okay, I'm not going on the road anytime soon with my comedic efforts. Yeah, okay. So we're gonna talk about Conjuring 2 here. I know this is gonna be a little controversial for people. People have already made up their mind. You've seen Conjuring, and you wrapped up in this thing. Well, I gotta talk about it. I mean, I just gotta mention this. So the movie Conjuring 2. Comes out in theaters June 10th and is obviously a sequel to the 2013 movie, The Conjuring. The first movie was the 19th highest grossing movie of 2013 and was based on a case from 1971 involving a farmhouse in Rhode Island. Now, the sequel is based on a bit more famous case, that of the Enfield Haunting, or also known as the Enfield Poltergeist. There seems to be a lot of heat coming ahead of this movie. I don't know why, but I've seen somebody put a GIF or a GIF. I guess it's supposed to be pronounced GIF, but everybody sees GIF and pronounces it GIF, I guess, in their heads. But it's supposed to be GIF. Anyway, there's this image, and it's essentially 4 images combined. And it shows this girl in a red dress leaping off a bed. That's essentially what she was doing. But apparently this was a poltergeist pulling her across the room or pushing her across the room, however you want to interpret that. But anyway, if you've seen this, and shame on me, I don't have it here in front of me. I guess I could find it. But it's 4 images. And the first image and the third image go together. They're sequential. The second image and the fourth image go together, and they're sequential from a different time period. I don't know if it was the same night or what. Hopefully, I don't know. But it is, those two are actually separate, which is weird. I don't know why they just didn't put one and three and together and two and four. I don't know. I didn't do it. I didn't make it. But if you've seen that, that's kind of caused a little bit of an issue about this thing. And there's been some people that have made some comments about that and the case, which kind of hurts the movie itself. And, you know, before I get too involved in that, I'll take a little break here and catch my breath so I can get ready for this. It's going to be a little nervous to talk about this, I'll be honest, because there's a lot of dissension, a lot of angry and hostile feelings about this that go both ways. But anyway, you're listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting from Youngstown, New York, emanating live at WCJVradio.com. And this is the Paranormal News Insider with your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. And if you're not in the chat room, you're not in the chat room. Good job, Dita. WCJV. Yeah. Well, I guess I started the conversation, so I got to end it. So anyway, The Conjuring 2, based on this Enfield Poltergeist case, which is, for me, getting into parapsychology and psychical research, when I first started out, when I wanted to learn what poltergeists were, I was confused, just like most people are about the term poltergeist, because there's actually three camps of poltergeists, and I'll kind of talk a little bit more about this through the story, but two camps are pretty popular, and they're basically, one is essentially that this is a ghost, it's an entity, whatever, people assign it to a low scale or whatever, but it's basically just a ghost that's up to no good, essentially, which is kind of weird. Doesn't make sense to me that to assign emotions and good and bad and all these things to it. That to me just doesn't make any sense. Another category of, or I shouldn't say category, another belief about poltergeists, which actually has a lot more validity to it through casework, through research, and it's one that I follow a little closer than any other kind of theory or hypothesis about poltergeists, is that they're essentially caused by psychokinesis of the living. And that's kind of what I learned in the beginning, but I don't get fixed into one thing because we don't really know. So I explore all areas and understand different viewpoints, but mine is more or less that there are PK driven psychokinesis, the living. There's an agent involved. Now, a lot of people think that it always has to be a girl going through puberty. That's not always the case. It's just cases like this, actually, that solidified that belief. That's not always true, but it is a good percentage of cases are that way. So that's why most people think that way. And the third camp is a poltergeist belief is that there are essentially demonic, essentially taking over the living. These are evil, potentially non-human entities that exist that, just, again, up to no good. It's in that no good class that wreak havoc on the living. But talking about this particular story, I've noticed two camps starting to form. Now, on one side of the tracks here, we have the Warren followers. I guess that's what I'll call them. These people, they feel that this movie is going to be fairly accurate in its interpretation of this particular case. I mean, the first movie supposedly was. I'll be honest. Again, I didn't watch it, so I don't know. And I don't really know anything about that first case that they talked about, but the ghost activity too, they think is going to be accurate. I don't know how or why, judging from the trailer. Yeah. Now, many people feel that way. They're sold on this because they believe in the ghost activity and things. So they feel this way partially due to their respect for Lorraine, which I've met Lorraine Warren and I respect her for some of the things she does. I'll just leave it right there. And the now deceased Ed Warren, never got to meet him, unfortunately. also partially due to their mere belief in the paranormal. And I think a lot of it does have to do with people's belief in the paranormal. They want to believe it's true. And any kind of attack on a movie or attack on a story, well, some people get really upset about that. I don't know why. Don't take it personal. It's not you. It's not you. It's a story. It's a movie. It's a book. It's whatever. It's not you. Don't worry. It's okay. Your feelings will get better. Just put a little ice on them. They'll be okay. Now, on the other side of the fence, there are those that are highly skeptical of this purported movie and the facts behind the actual case of the Enfield poltergeist itself. And then he goes so far as to say the Warrens were frauds and were not even part of the Enfield case and should not be highlighted in a film dealing with this case. And I've seen a number of expletives shoveled out on both sides of the fence. So I'm going to kind of play referee here and explain some of the truth behind what purportedly happened back in 1977. Well, first off, the case lasted from 1977, sometime in the fall, I think it was in August, to 77 to 1979, and involved Peggy Hodgson, her daughters, Margaret, age 13, Janet, age 11, and sons, Johnny and Billy, who were 10 and 7, respectively, at the start of these events. And I'm not going to go through all the details or all the things. Just essentially, the police were called in August of 1977 when two of the children reported moving furniture. Their beds were moving and other objects were moving in the home. The police came and they were of no help. They couldn't figure anything out. You can't arrest the ghost. You can try. They didn't have tasers. Maybe that would have worked. I don't know. They could not explain any of the events, even when one of them actually saw a chair move. Now, that is a fact. Peggy had various news outlets visiting the home and also witnessed phenomena, moving objects, hearing noises, all kinds of things happening. Now, members of the Society for Psychical Research, which Society for Psychical Research was formed in 1882 in Cambridge, England, a number of scientists came together to want to figure out what was going on with paranormal phenomena, what's going on with ghosts and all these ghost stories. Is there validation to this? Can we scientifically prove the existence of ghosts? Well, psychical research moved into the laboratory in the 1920s, 1930s, and became parapsychology. Now, the Society for Psychical Research set up an American unit here in the United States, beginning in Baltimore, and then it moved to New York City. 1885, it was formed. The American arm, and both of those organizations still exist today. Now, during the case, reporters were given confessions by the girls that they were actually causing many of the events. So Society for Psychical Research came out, and there was actually, they're not just psychical researchers. These people have other jobs, and they just represent the Society for Psychical Research as investigators to these particular cases. And there was also psychologists that arrived and investigated as well. Maurice Gross and Guy Lyon Playfair were SPR members that came to investigate. And they caused just as much problems as the girls did, pretty much. They actually tried to convince the girls to retract their statements that they made to the media. Now, the media involved at the beginning of the case were actually The Mirror and other tabloid newspapers. So these weren't actually legitimate reporting journalists. These were just tabloids. And these are still around today, and they're much worse than what they were. But they're not always about the facts. They're just about stories, about selling newspapers back then, especially. We didn't have online stuff back then in 1977. But what about the Warrens? Got to talk about the Warrens. I mean, it's their movie, right? Based on the case files of the Warrens, right? Well, skeptics say that the Warrens were not really part of the investigation. Well, were they? Well, actually, they're wrong. They were part of it, but they're also a little right. They weren't really that big of a part of it. Now, the Warrens showed up in the summer of 1978, almost a year after all this stuff happened, when it was just really picking up here in the United States, beginning to get a lot of media attention. And reportedly were actually uninvited. They just showed up on their own. None of the investigators invited them, which there were multiple investigators. Again, the SPR, there were psychologists that showed up. There were other investigators from other areas of investigation that just showed up, or that Peggy Hodgson contacted to come in and look at all this stuff. So Playfair, who I mentioned, a member of the SPR, commented to the press actually just last year that the Warrens were only with the case for one day and that Ed Warren told him during the case that he could make a lot of money from it. That doesn't sound good. Granted, Playfair made a lot of mistakes with this investigation. A lot of questionable evidence and information. He led the girls quite a bit with his statements, made just a lot of critical errors in judgment in dealing with this case that really kind of ruined it and altered the landscape of this investigation. He could have discovered all these things, whether it was real or a hoax all along, but he just had it made up in his mind that this was true, and he wasn't going to let the facts get in the way, unfortunately. And he also wrote his own book about the events called This House is Haunted, The Investigation of the Infield Poltergeist. So Mr. Pot meet Mr. Kettle, I guess. You know, the Warrens made plenty of statements about the case, but as it began to unravel and more evidence pointed toward a hoax, and again, the Warrens were behind this all along and kind of trying to change. At the time, it was just thought of as a mischievous ghost causing havoc, wreaking havoc, playing with these girls' minds. And at the same time, they knew that the girls were creating some of the stuff. They got caught, caught on camera, caught by investigators numerous times, creating hoaxes, throwing things across the room, throwing things at other people or moving objects or making noises. So, you know, a lot of science pointed toward it being a hoax, but there were some really interesting things happening that couldn't be explained. But along came the Warrens. And all of a sudden, this became quite different. It pointed toward some kind of non-human entity. It pointed towards this girl being possessed, which no one really had thought about that. They kind of postulated that due to some of the evidence. But as the Warrens arrived, the case kind of took a different direction. And Playfair and other investigators kind of jumped on that wagon. But with a lot of these things starting to unravel and looking that it was more of a hoax, as this case kind of started to unwind, it began to paint the Warrens themselves as potential hucksters. So was Janet really possessed? I guess that's one question that people will want to know while watching this movie. I mean, the movie makes her look like a demon. They always had the dark eyes, and it's you know, underneath her eyes are black, and she's crawling on the ceiling and all these weird things. Everything but the pea soup, I guess. Well, we'll find out if she actually does that in this movie. I don't know. While some information seems hard to hoax, and if you read any of the accounts, especially by Playfair, he is by far convinced, and he convinced a lot of other people as well that this was genuine activity from beginning to end, even though some of it was admitted by Janet, and even Margaret was chiming in, and even the boys got caught doing stuff. So who knows? So again, a lot of it seemed hard to hoax, and there were many statements made by the girls and information gathered by investigators that pointed that this was probably not the case. Now, the entire Infield Poltergeist case is looked upon as a hoax by a lot of people. But again, a lot of true believers stick to the belief that this was the best proof of poltergeist activity or possession, depending upon which side of the paranormal coin you prefer, in history. Now, my personal opinion, this is just my opinion. You don't have to go on social media and bash me and tell me how wrong I am or how crazy I am to believe these things. I'm willing to believe that there was a little bit of truth to some of this activity. Probably more or less true poltergeist activity based on some of the evidence that was gathered, some of the things that happened that could not be explained. But I would have to say overall, of all the things that were gathered, hundreds of events that happened, nobody really knows the exact number, but it's been estimated at over 1,500 events in the 3 years that it was investigated and closely studied, closely monitored. Even when Margaret was removed from the situation Janet was removed from the situation for a while. I still think that overall, this case was mostly a hoax. I believe that probably Janet was more or less the agent for the poltergeist activity. It could have been a combination of the girls. I've read cases that it takes two sometimes to create the perfect storm for this. But it seemed like the activity followed Janet pretty closely, which is brought on by the unreleased stress. Again, poltergeist, in my viewpoint, is unreleased stress strain, which is released as psychokinesis, uncontrollable, just kind of stress in the environment. And it just affects objects, it affects things. And they're not doing it on purpose. Well, maybe she was on some accounts, but real true poltergeist behavior, you don't even know you're doing it. Even when you realize you're doing it, it doesn't change anything. It actually can make things a little worse there for a little while. And but I just don't think that it was completely genuine. I think the girls really liked the attention. And they had even admitted it. They really enjoyed that attention they got. But as far as possession, I know they say possession is 9/10 of the law, but no, that's different possession. As far as possession, it really didn't hold much in the way of evidence for this claim. I'm not an expert in demonology or anything like that, but I have read about it. I have researched it quite a bit over the years. And this particular case just didn't seem like it. Everything changed when people made assumptions, or people asked questions, or people made assertions about what was going on with this particular case. And that's when things change. And it shouldn't work that way. It should be, you see how things are going, and then we make the correlation with all this stuff. But it was kind of the other way around. And as for the movie, I've only seen the trailers, so I really can't speculate too much. It doesn't come out again until June 10th. There will be a lot of dramatization, which, again, we've already seen it from the trailer, and many things we have not seen. When you watch the trailer, I mean, I could go frame by frame or thing by thing, but most of that stuff that's in there didn't happen. The girl up on the roof or the ceiling, the cross is upside down. That stuff never happened. And if you haven't seen it, you haven't seen the trailer, well, I have that as well, and I'll be pushing that out to social media during the week as well. And I'm going to throw that in the chat room. Speaking of chat room, greetings to everybody that's in there. You know, I have a bad habit of kind of ignoring you guys. Cindy, Dita, Cheryl, Paul, those guys are always there, always supporting me, and I really appreciate it. And I see that Jim Mallard of the Mallard Report is also in there as well. So greetings, Jim. Good to see you in there as well. So I got one more story here. It's about a psychic. A psychic with the S spelled a little differently. It's an S, and it's got two little vertical lines through it. Yeah. Well, I've talked about scams regarding psychics over the years here on the Paranormal News Insider. And this next story is sadly an example of how some people like to take advantage of others. And it really annoys me that there are people out there that have genuine abilities. Some people don't. I'd say a lot of people that claim to be psychic don't actually have any ability at all. They're just really good guessers, or they have really good intuition, or they're just really good at reading people. And, you know, there are some people that have a genuine, I can't explain sometimes, some people that I've worked with in the past that really know information. They know it without knowing, and it's scary. But you can tell. I've talked to enough people that have claimed to be psychic. I can tell pretty much within about 5 minutes or less. But anyway, some people, unfortunately, like to take it a little further and try to make money off of it. And this particular story all started with a $100 crystal ball reading and ultimately led to a $41,000 scam. The 25-year-old psychic from Paramus, New York, named Holly Stanley, told a 30-year-old New Jersey woman that spirits were interfering with her life. And just for the low price of $5,000, she could rid the spirits from her life. That sounds like a good deal, right? Why not? It's an investment. So she paid the $5,000, but was told later after more sessions that the spirits were, quote, rather stubborn, unquote, and that it would take another $36,000 to get rid of them. Seems legit. Well, the woman paid again, But a while later, upon being asked to pay another $90,000, woof, the woman finally got wise and contacted police. Stanley was arrested and charged with theft by deception and released on $5,000 bail. Now, in typical psychic scam defense, which I've heard this before, if you've read these stories, Stanley stated the money was a loan from the woman and that she had a contract written in ink. Again, I've heard them say this before. It's just weird why they do that. But she told this information to NBC4 New York via a telephone call. But when asked to elaborate on that information about this contract, she stated, quote, "I'd like all of this nonsense to stop," unquote, and then hung up the phone. Good job. This case highlights a couple of pieces of that scam. The psychic usually gets the person hooked after a cold reading. And a cold reading is essentially just looking at somebody and kind of knowing about them based on their body language, what they're wearing, who they're with, what they talk about, kind of questions. We've all done that. We've seen somebody, we've made snap judgments, but these people are really good at that. Some people can really, really read somebody really well. And when you connect with somebody, people will start to trust you a lot more. And they also know, based on looking at somebody, you know, their jewelry, their hair, their nails, their clothing, pretty much how much they can, they're willing to pay to get the ball rolling and to change their life. And based on that, then they just keep making it sound like you have to pay more for this stuff to stop. And I've met people that have unfortunately been part of that runaway train. And it's an addiction sometimes that people want these other people to help them. And these psychics use a lot of things against them and to get them to part with their money. Now, once the person is hooked, the psychic uses, you know, a lot of different tactics and to make that mark feel guilty and make them feel like they owe the psychic money or make it out to be a loan, like this particular story. And that's basically to establish a further emotional context. Now, a loan is something that you pay back. So this person feels like it's an investment in helping. And it's also just kind of a legality thing to get them out of that, to go to jail. They all know what they're doing. But a lot of them end up getting caught, but usually end up taking the person away from their money. And they end up being broken and happy in the end. So usually it doesn't turn out right. But unfortunately, it happens. And, you know, we can say, people are stupid. How could they allow that to happen? But I'll be honest with you. I've met plenty of people that were very sane, very level-headed, that unfortunately just they just got caught up emotionally and then financially. And it's a game. It's a psychological thing that a lot of people do to take advantage of other people, unfortunately. It's sad but true. So our book of the week this week, I was going to do my Steve Coles book that I've really enjoyed. It's a really good book. Really got into it. Not quite done with it yet. But for the story that we talked about here with this Enfield poltergeist case, I wanted to talk about a book that I have on my library shelf here called The Poltergeist Phenomenon, An Investigation into Psychic Disturbance. This book is from 1997. Not quite that old. 1997, written by John and Ann Spencer, who they're researchers. They've been around quite a while, and they've done a lot of stuff with the poltergeist phenomena here, obviously. They are members of the SPR, Society for Psychical Research, and the Association of the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena, ASSAP. And they have researched at the time, back in 97, over 20 years with poltergeists. And this book is, sorry, Dita, yeah, I beat you to it. The book there is in the chat room. You can check out Amazon. It's pretty cheap on Amazon.com. I think it's like 98 cents, plus you'd have to pay shipping. That's a hardcover. I have a softcover little book here. And they basically talk about historical cases leading off this book. They talk about the Bell Witch, the Tennessee case, a few pages there. And they use cases to explain what poltergeists are. Now, the context of this book is essentially they're looking at it as poltergeists are angry ghosts, that there are entities, free-thinking entities, that are not human-derived. Now, on occasion, I noticed that they do kind of flex towards the other alternative definition without giving any credit for that, but they do kind of move around with their theories, but for the most part, stick to the one that this is an entity separate from that of actual ghosts or psychokinetic type of activity. And they do on page 56, they do talk about, I don't know, it's a softcover book, might be different in a hardcover book that you buy. They do talk about the Anfield case, and I read through it and I was kind of shaking my head. This is like pretty much from the Playfair and Gross breakdown that ended up being published in the SPR, the Society for Psychical Research. I don't remember what edition that was. I did read that online somewhere some time ago. But yeah, the Daily Mirror and other places kind of helped jump to conclusions about this case and got these psychical researchers all wrapped up in stuff as well. And yeah, it's almost frustrating to read this because it's based on their opinion. It's not really based on observations and facts, because they pretty much about 10 times through they say that none of this could be repeated. None of this could be hoaxed. And I think they were just trying to convince themselves. Again, it's a good read. There is a lot of cases in here, dozens of cases. Now, some of them I don't really agree with being put on as poltergeists. They put Maggie and Kate Fox, the Fox sisters, 1848 case in here as a poltergeist case. That's confusing to me. That's not really known historically as a case that is a poltergeist. But again, they're taking poltergeist as a frisky ghost or a noisy ghost is what people translate, but that's not actually accurate. A ghost that's just wreaking havoc or doing things that normal ghosts, I guess, don't do. I didn't know there was rules to ghosts, which anytime you hear people talk about definitions or rules or limitations of ghosts, they're pretty much talking out of their rear end, because that's really not how it works. There is no the way it works, but that's what people believe, and that's what people believe. So that's my kind of rehash on this book. If you're interested in poltergeists, it is a good book, but again, it's factual, it's documentation, but they inflect their opinion about this phenomena quite a bit, and so it's really heavy overtones about their opinions. But it will give you a good idea of the overall poltergeist phenomena. Again, The Poltergeist Phenomenon, An Investigation into Psychic Disturbance by John and Ann Spencer. A good overview of the topic with really a ton of cases, a lot of great research. But again, if I could really do without the heavy overtones of their personal beliefs and things like that. But nonetheless, it's on my bookshelf. Well, I only paid $5. I got it at the Half Price bookstore, so it's worth it. Anyway, conferences, conventions, other paranormal gatherings. We got a lot coming up here towards the end of May. The Ars Esoterica 2016, Denver, Colorado. Be there. We should have called it the Mile High Fun or Mile High Paranormal Convention. I don't know. Pennhurst Paracon coming up June 4th and the 5th in Spring City, Pennsylvania. Fort Fest, June 11th and 12th. That's Fort Fest, like Charles Fort. That's in Hanover, Maryland. And the 59th Annual Convention of the Parapsychological Association and the 35th Annual Conference of the Society for Scientific Exploration are combined. It's two events, one weekend, June 19th to the 24th. Well, I guess that's the whole week, in Boulder, Colorado. Both of these events are being combined together to create Accessing the Exceptional, Experiencing the Extraordinary. It's a big event with both of these two conferences and convention together on that weekend in Boulder. Pretty cool. Toward the end of June, the Haunted America Conference 2016, June 24th and 25th in Olton, Illinois. Now, the Fort Fest, let me go back up to that. I just added that recently. That's got a lot of UFO stuff and a little bit of cryptid stuff. And just because I'm saying it's a paranormal convention, it doesn't mean it's all ghosts. I categorize this. And if you check out the website, paranewsinsider.com, the events tab at the top, it shows you it's all broken down by segment. I just put it in the category where a majority of the case is dealing with, such as contact in the desert, June 3rd to the 6th in Joshua Tree, California, mostly a UFO event. That's why it's under UFOs. The 2016 MUFON of Ohio conference coming up June 18th. I don't know where that's at because it says location to be D, so I got to fix that. Creature Weekend, June 3rd to the 5th in Cryptozoology, Cambridge, Ohio. You could check out the entire list again, paranewsinsider.com. Click on the events tab at the top. And if you have any information about any event and would like to hear it here, as well as see it on the website, let me know at insider@paranewsinsider.com, and I'll get that taken care of for you. I do a pretty good job, and I've had a lot of people compliment me on this list. I know I've helped out a few people get some information on conferences and conventions. It's something I do because I love these things. They're great to go to. I love to speak at them, but I also enjoy going to them, and I know a lot of people do too. So I do this, and this is probably one of the best lists you're going to see out there as far as paranormal conferences and conventions. Check it out. And again, if you have any conference or convention idea that you know out there, whether you're putting it on or not, that I don't have on here, I can't see all and do all. So I appreciate it if you send that information to me, and I'll get it up on that site. And thank you very much. So again, thank you to those that showed up in the chat room to listen to me ramble for an hour. It's a lot of fun, and I appreciate you guys being there for me each and every week. Big thanks to Cindy, my producer, for putting this shindig on and running this entire thing. It's a lot of work, and really can't thank her enough for allowing me to have my program here. And if I don't cut this off, she's probably going to cut me off. So, Dita in the chat room, thank you as well. Even though I'm putting up the book stuff for you, I don't know what's going on. And everyone else out there, if you're listening in on an archive, I appreciate you as well. Thank you. Keep your eyes in the skies, your ears in the woods, the hair standing on the back of your neck, and always keep your mind slightly ajar. And above all else, don't stop believing. For the Paranormal News Insider, this is Dr. Brian D. Parsons reporting.
Listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.